I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today. A brief announcement before we get on to the main event of the program. I want to remind you again that the 12th annual Veggie Pride Parade celebration is this April 4th, 2019 in Manhattan. It's a free annual event, and it brings the community together to celebrate animal-friendly, environmentally sustainable, and healthy lifestyles. It's a lot of fun. You can come dressed like your favorite fruit or vegetable or animal or other themed costume. And there's a lot of things that go on. And I'll be there. My nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living, will have a table. Come and say hi. And I'm part of the long lineup of speakers that will be there. So I hope you will stop by if you're in the Manhattan area on Sunday, April 14th. For more, go to veggieprideparade.org. Veggieprideparade.org. Excellent. Okay, right to the meat of the program, no pun intended. Yes, pun intended. I have with me Dr. Will Tuttle, the author of the best-selling The World Peace Diet, published in 16 languages, a recipient of the Courage of Conscious Award and the Empty Cages Prize. He is also the author of Your Inner Islands and editor of Circles of Compassion, as well as the creator of online wellness and advocacy programs, a vegan since 1980, and a former Zen monk in the Korean Zen tradition. He is featured in a number of documentary films. A Buddhist practitioner for over 40 years, he is a frequent radio, television, and online presenter and lectures extensively worldwide. He's also a very nice guy. Hi, Will. How are you?
Great, Karen. Thank you so much for having me on and for the great work you're doing, and great to be with you.
Thank you. I have not seen you in a very long time.
Right.
But I love all of the wonderful work that you are doing.
Well, thanks. Yeah, we've been busy. We've been doing a lot of lecturing lately and traveling, and it's really very inspiring and encouraging to see how vegan movement is continuing to grow, and the momentum, I think, is continuing to build all over the world where we've traveled. So a lot of good news there.
Yeah, it's definitely transforming.
Right.
And
right. And
there are good things about the transforming, maybe some not so good things, but we're going to hit on all of those things and how they connect with Buddhism.
Great.
So let's start with Buddhism. Can you give us like a very brief statement about what Buddhism is?
Sure. Yeah. As you know, I'll just mention it. We have a brand new book that just came out called Buddhism and Veganism, Essays Connecting Spiritual Awakening and Animal Liberation. And so the basic teaching in Buddhism, the word Bud, B-U-D-H, the root in Sanskrit means awaken or wake up. And Buddha is one who has awakened or has awakened out of the basically out of a cultural trance. That's the underlying idea in Buddhism, that we're all essentially under a delusion, and that delusion creates suffering. And so Buddhism doesn't really have, it has an ethical orientation. It's not so much rooted in good and evil. It's more rooted in the idea of delusion and awakening, or skillful and unskillful actions. You know, skillful actions are based on understanding the underlying truth of the interconnectedness of all life, that all beings have consciousness and yearn for the same thing, which is to be free of suffering. So when we act out of delusion, and the basic delusion is the delusion of being a fundamentally separate self, which leads to greed and wanting more for myself and using others as instruments, and so forth, and to try to keep away what I don't want in this endless struggle. And when everyone is under this delusion, we have what is referred to as samsara, which is suffering that never ends. As long as the delusion continues, the suffering continues. So we can't really awaken anyone else. The only one we can actually awaken is ourselves. But by doing that, by making an effort to awaken ourselves, we can then have a solid foundation for helping the world, for helping others to awaken also. So it's very much a philosophy and a way of life and a religion that's based on inner work. The foundation really is meditation. The Noble Eightfold Path, the last two of that are meditation and, you know, sort of the inner work, contemplation and meditation, and also based on right livelihood and kindness and so forth as well. So I just love it. I mean, I've been practicing Buddhism since college, which is going way back into the early 1970s, so I guess it's almost 50 years now. And I was a Zen Buddhist monk in Korea back in the mid-1980s, and just have been studying this for many years and seeing how it fits in really with other Eastern traditions like Confucianism and Taoism and yoga and so forth, the Hindu traditions. And also I think it's inspiring a lot of people today in the West, both directly and indirectly through the work of Emerson and Thoreau and sort of the New Thought movement, the Unity movement. Unitarian Universalism has been somewhat influenced. And so the influence is enormous, actually, I think. And I would actually even say that the whole vegan movement essentially is a product primarily of Buddhism. If you go back to the core, go back to the roots, and I can talk more about that if you'd like.
Absolutely. Well, I was thinking while I was reading this book, and I was nodding my head in agreement everywhere, yes, 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 yes. And I have not read very much about Buddhism, and I don't pretend to know much about it. But as I was reading all of the explanations, I was thinking, yes, I agree with that, or I have come to that kind of conclusion or that awakenedness from a different path. And I thought, I need to read more, and I need to learn more, because I'm sure I could be more enlightened from others who have given so much more thought to this. But I really see the connection between Buddhism and veganism, and you've made that very clear in this book. It was great to read.
Thanks. So, yeah, it is very fascinating to actually begin to see what the teachings are. You're right.
And you were a Buddhist first before you were a vegan.
Well, that's actually, yeah, I would say they both came about pretty much at the same time. You know, I was in college. I was back in the early 1970s. Vietnam War was happening, and then I started questioning just the war and the whole mentality gradually at the West, seemed like. And then that led to, you know, the hippies thing was kind of happening, and yoga became popular. So I started to read some books on yoga that led to Zen and meditation. And I ended up leaving home with my brother. Thought we would just walk all the way to California. That was the idea. We were going to kind of on a spiritual pilgrimage, meditating to attain awakening. Because when I read these ideas, they weren't just ideas. I mean, they were transformative, powerful, inspirational kinds of ideas, I guess you'd say. I mean, I really felt like, gosh, I don't want to waste my life going to a job where I'm just distracted with mundane details for 60 years, and I end up, like most people, just wondering, you know, now I die. What did I do here? I just contributed to more suffering, and I didn't, you know, I could just see that it's really a big danger in not questioning the path that our society lays out. So I was really on fire when I was 21, 22 years old to find meaning in my life and not just waste my life. And so my brother, luckily, agreed with me completely. Mm-hmm. So the two of us, you know, had this kind of idealistic thing. We walked off, and no money, no nothing. Just, you know, thought we'd walk all the way to California. We got as far as Buffalo, New York, and in Buffalo, we ended up just heading south because it was getting cold. It was in October, November, so we actually ended up walking all the way to Alabama, and it took us quite a few months. But on the way, we stopped for a while in a community called The Farm, which in 1975 was actually the largest hippie commune in the world. They had almost 1,000 people there, and they were all vegetarians. They said they were actually vegans. No one heard of the word vegan in 1975, so they just said, well, we're vegetarians. And that was it. I was already meditating a lot. I wasn't really considering myself a Buddhist. I was just interested in Zen and meditating. And then that led me to really starting to question the food, although it wasn't until I saw this example of a vegan community, and they were also inspired primarily by Zen. They were like Stephen Gaskin, who was the main teacher, was considered himself a student of Suzuki Roshi, who was the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. And so they were really all reading that book that had just come out, and I was reading it too, called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and finding it really very inspiring by Suzuki Roshi. And so I became a vegetarian right then, just being at the farm, see these people not eating meat and all thriving, and kids thriving, everybody thriving. You know, that was it. I never ate meat in my life again after that. So it was very much, and then we walked down to Huntsville, Alabama. Took us another, whatever, a month, and we got there, and we were in a Zen. So then I was living in a Zen center as a vegetarian, and I did that there and in Atlanta, and then lived in a Tibetan Buddhist center in San Francisco eventually as a vegetarian for a few years. And during that time, I just learned more about dairy and egg production. And it wasn't quite so well known back then in the early 1980s, or late 70s. So I became actually a vegan in 1980, and I had become a Buddhist right a few years before that. So it kind of all happened at the same time, I guess you would say. It was part of the same initial thing. I wasn't trying to be healthier. I just wanted to have a spiritual path that was not conflicted with, you know, causing violence. It just didn't seem to go together at all. But it was kind of weird, too, because I remember at the Tibetan Buddhist Center, you know, everybody, all of us as students were vegetarians, and the lama was actually eating meat, so we had to prepare meat for him. he was our spiritual teacher. You know, it was kind of like one of those things which I think a lot of people go through in the Buddhist movement. They go vegetarian or vegan themselves, and they find the monks are eating meat, and they're going, what the heck is this? I thought Buddhism was supposed to be about compassion and all that, and, you know, why are these monks and nuns, or why are these spiritual teachers eating animal foods? And so that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, or actually edited this book, Buddhism and Veganism, was to try to help explain that. And there are different traditions within Buddhism, and generally speaking, most of the Mahayana traditions, which are northern, like from China and Korea, they are actually vegan oriented. So when I went to Korea in 1984 as a Zen monk, it was great because the whole monastery was vegan, and they've been practicing veganism for 850 years, you know, wow, just since the 1200s. So it was very refreshing to be there and just, you know, no meat, dairy, or eggs, no wool, silk, no leather, no fur, no killing insects. It was just practicing ahimsa as the foundational teaching. The basic idea is that if we're really serious about growing spiritually, and especially having a more clear and quiet mind, then harming others is exactly the opposite of that. It disturbs us. It makes us upset. We create a world of conflict around us, and we're never going to be at peace if we're eating animal foods. I mean, if eating animal foods is the opposite of inner peace, because we're causing suffering to other beings. And that's the thing, in the most Eastern traditions, the precept not to kill, while in the West, that usually only refers to humans. In the East, that refers to all living beings. It's specifically inclusive. When we say not killing or harming, it means all living beings. And I think that's probably because the Western religious traditions like Christianity, Judaism, and Islam pretty much were forged under herding societies, you know, just totally herding societies where the people are eating animal food. So the religion that we have here in the West pretty much doesn't question that too much. Whereas in Asia, they were more plant-based in their eating, I think, or the herding wasn't quite so widespread. So there was more of the natural compassion, I think, in caring for animals that really is part of our true nature, I think, as human beings, is reflected in these traditions. Because, like, when we were in China, we found that, I didn't realize it, but even Confucianism, which is one of the main religions in China, was also promoting veganism as well. And a lot of the, of course, as people know, Taoist traditions are pretty oriented that way. But I think, in general, the beautiful impulse that gave rise to Buddhism and some of the other traditions in India back 500 BC that really helped transform India into what it is today, still a vegetarian-oriented country. It was really, I think, the Buddhist influence, and as well as the Jain and some of the other teachers back then, that really changed things quite a bit.
I have a lot of questions. I don't know that we'll get to them all, but I want to talk about the book. But before we jump into the book, a number of things I wanted to mention. First, I want to mention the artwork by your wife, Madeline, which is very lovely and very lighthearted and colorful and just so happy and delightful to look at.
Right. Yeah, she actually went to Japan before I had met her and studied Zen art. It's called sumi-e, the brush painting. People are probably familiar with that. So it's very fortuitous that she has this whole Zen Buddhist art background too. Mm-hmm. So it worked well with the book, right?
Yeah, well, it works. Okay, so, and you know, you were mentioning your beginnings, how you went out with your brother on this journey, and when we're young, we're adventurous and we want to know the meaning, and then somehow we get caught up in the delusion. And you had a lot of courage not to buy into that. It takes courage. I just want to underline that. It takes courage.
Right.
Okay. And a couple of other things before we get to the book. This clear, quiet mind. You talk about monks going through times of silence. What does that do for us when people go through an experience of silence?
Well, I think it's a very healing, potentially very healing practice, because when we are in a situation where we've taken a vow of silence, and I've done that a number of times, where it's just we're supported in that. Either we're in a monastery or in a meditation center, and there's no talking for 5 days or whatever. For us, it was like 90 days. I remember at one point, and
wow.
I've done other ones, but it's it really supports this creating a container that's not so leaky in a way in our mind. Yeah, it's like, you know, we live in a society where we're so bombarded with input, and then plus we're also expressing ourselves a lot. I mean, we're talking on the phone, or we're talking to people, we're writing emails, and we're continually interacting. And so our mind has so much that it needs to digest based on what we're receiving and what we're putting out. And so our mind gets really kind of overheated. And it's very difficult, I think, to experience extended and a deep and extended sense of harmony and, you know, inner silence while we're still doing a lot of talking. And so, like on these meditation retreats, we take a vow of silence and we don't talk. Basically, you don't need to typically. And so, things are set up and you're meditating and eating and everything's done in silence. And it allows the mind to just relax back into the present moment, and we become more attentive to what's actually happening in our mind, in our body, and old wounds, perhaps, that have been repressed can come up to be healed. It can be very therapeutic on that level. We can begin to, you know, connect more with the unique being that we are and get to know ourselves a little bit. You know, what I realized, you know, I was raised in a typical family, eating the usual meals and running around, being busy all the time, and I had such a realization, I guess, and a craving for silence and inner simplicity. And so, luckily, my brother and I ended up at this Zen center in Alabama, where we just meditated all day from 6 o'clock in the morning till about 9 o'clock at night. We had this room. They gave us a room and said, "Here, you can just go and be there." So we just sat there, and it was it's very difficult, but we just felt like this was the most important thing to do. So we did that for quite a few months, and I think it helped create a foundation gradually of just sort of establishing myself as a being that's not programmed. You know, I actually could start to see the program.
Mm-hmm.
I could see that thoughts would come up in my mind that were actually from my parents or from my whatever I had seen on TV when I was younger, whatever. And I could even feel the yearning to act on those thoughts, you know. But I could kind of learn to just witness it, to just watch it, and realize that's just the program. It's not me. It's not who I am. So that, I think, is very, very helpful to actually get an intimate sort of understanding of how our mind has been programmed without our consent, really. I mean, it's just from the time we're born, we get programmed with all these thoughts and feelings and aspirations that we're supposed to have, and idea of who we are, what we're supposed to do, a mask that we have to put on every day, basically. And to actually realize that we are the consciousness beyond all of that, that is observing, and that we're free, essentially. We don't have to go along with it.
Many people are afraid to be silent. Many people are afraid not to say anything. It takes courage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It takes courage. I think it takes also just wanting, you know, yearning for something beyond just, you know, I think if we suffer enough, maybe, you know, the courage comes. Like we realize, gosh, you know, this is really painful. There's an old saying in the Buddhist tradition that for the typical person, the aggravation that we go through is like a hair just rubbing our palm. You know, so it's not that bad. But for someone whose heart is opened to the possibility of another way of living, then it's like a hair rubbing against our eyeball. You know, it's just, it's really very, very irritating. We want to do something to relieve that suffering. So we're willing, like I was willing to just, okay, I'm going to live in meditation centers. I'm not going to worry about making money. I'm not going to worry about relationships. I just want to focus on the one most important thing. And because I could, to me, it just felt like without doing that, I'm just a programmed, kind of like a robot. I'm just following these orders. And that's what I think people do, like with veganism. Most people realize that the only reason I was eating animal foods all those years was because I was just following orders. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason anyone eats meat and dairy and eggs, is because we're just following orders. No one does it out of a free choice. You know, it's just what we're
doing. Young children don't do it out of a free choice. So many of them turn away from it.
They do. They know better. But they have to, pretty much. I had to. I couldn't, like, say, oh, I'm not going to eat this meat. That was, like, unthinkable in my family growing up. So I think that's where it all comes together. You know, it's this liberating animals, liberating ourselves.
When I was young, I was raised Jewish, and I insisted on going to Hebrew school because the boys were going to Hebrew school. It was a feminist thing. Mm-hmm. And my parents weren't very religious. And I learned a lot there. It was the first place I'd experience prejudice and discrimination against me because the boys got more favors than the girls did.
Yes, right.
But something that was so important that we were taught was how special the Jewish religion was, because it was the first that identified the self. And they kept telling us how important it was. We're individual. And how different that was. And in hindsight, I'm thinking, that wasn't such a great thing, because there's so many replications that came out of that. And then another thing, which is going to lead into my next question, is so I'm not religious at all anymore. I'm just a vegan.
Right.
But I remember the kosher laws. And to me, it seemed part of the kosher law is that you can't eat an animal who has blood in it. You have to drain the blood. And
right.
I thought that was like a trick. I was like, that means you can't eat any of them because you can never get all the blood out of them. It's a trick.
Right. I know.
So let's go to, in Buddhism, the three cases meat may not be used.
Right. Yeah. So basically, the way it goes in the what's called the Theravada, or the sort of traditional school of Buddhism, is that it's okay to eat meat as long as the three conditions are not present. The three conditions are that we have seen, or we have heard, or we have suspected that the animal was killed specifically for us. So the idea is that, and this is basically a rule for monks who are traveling around back in the day, you know, 500 BC in India, where they're just begging for food. So they're going, you know, once a day they go out through the villages, and they have their bowl, and they put the bowl out, and whatever puts in the bowl is put in the bowl. They will eat, but if it's meat, they're not allowed to eat the meat if they have reason, you know, they've heard or seen or suspect that the animal was killed just for them, because the whole idea is we don't kill. And so the idea was, well, if, you know, if the family had already killed an animal and they just had some of the flesh hanging around, then they could put that in your bowl. It's not your fault, you know, so you can eat that. So that basically is the foundation, even today, why most monks and nuns who are eating meat say it's okay to do it. Because they say, well, Buddha said it's okay if it wasn't just for you. You know, so of course, people look at that today and they say, well, that's kind of ridiculous, because today if we go to a store or a restaurant or anywhere to get meat, even though it wasn't killed just for me personally, if I buy it, then there's, you know, the inventory is reduced, and then an animal will be killed specifically because of my purchase, right? They have to replace that, so mm-hmm. It's definitely causing it. So a lot of people say, you know, how can they use that ridiculous excuse today? And I think more or less, that's what it is. It's just kind of an excuse. Plus, I think personally, and there's quite a lot of evidence to support this, that back in the day, again, when these rules were made up, that it was well understood that Buddhist monks were not eating meat, that this was part of, you know, their discipline, that they didn't eat animal foods. And so a layperson anyway, it would be kind of insulting for them to put the flesh of an animal in the bowl of a Buddhist monk. Would be kind of like, you know, that's not something that they would eat. But the thing is that what's happened, I think, is that in the last couple hundred years, the Western civilization basically has gone into Thailand and Burma and Sri Lanka and the whole southern part of Asia with eating meat being something that's really much more readily available now, and it's also something that's more prestigious. So now the monks, when they go out to the villages, actually, the villagers don't have enough money really to buy meat for themselves, but when they see the monks, they really honor the monks. They want to give them something that they cannot afford themselves, so they give them some meat, and the monks accept it because they think, well, you know, they're doing the best and they're giving us this. And so This is what's been happening in the southern schools of Buddhism, and why the monks accept it is because I think they feel like they're being honored and they don't want to refuse it, and this has percolated all the way through. Plus, I think in trying to bring Buddhism to the West, it's an obstacle to being successful in spreading the Buddhist message if it's all vegetarian and vegan, because so many people eat meat, and I think a lot of the teachers feel that, well, you know, they don't want to emphasize that because maybe people won't be interested because they want to keep eating meat. So that's the situation. But what happened, as we talk about in the book, there's several essays that talk about how when Buddhism went to China and then from there to Japan and to Korea and to Vietnam, they made a conscious decision back in, I think it was around the year 600 AD, that absolutely no meat is allowed. I mean, and they never did dairy anyway, so there was no dairy. That wasn't even an issue. So it was completely vegan, what we would call vegan. In a sense, it was totally plant-based diet-wise, and they also have sutras that include leather and so forth as well. So this is really interesting to me that, you know, going way back 1,500 years, we have a whole religion growing in China and spreading from there to other East Asian countries that's completely what we would call today vegan, in the sense that it's based on a motivation of compassion and respect and kindness for other beings. It includes everything we eat, everything we wear, everything we do. And that's really the foundation, I think, for the whole movement that we have. It's spread in various ways, like to the farm in Tennessee where I got it, you know, through the Zen Buddhist tradition, for example, or through, you know, other people that have been influenced, like Emerson and Thoreau and Alcott were influenced by the Asian cultures and so forth. So it's come seeping through in a whole variety of ways. But it was so interesting just to see that I know today in the vegan movement, one of the big things, of course, is to create really good replicas of meat and dairy and eggs so that it's easy to help people transition. And this is, they were doing this centuries ago.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to bring that up, the monks making the veggie meats.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's so interesting. Exactly. That's it. You know, because the wealthy donors back in the day, again, you know, way back, you know, 1,000 years ago, the monks wanted to, when the wealthy donors came to the monasteries, they would honor them with a meal. And of course, the wealthy donors were used to eating chicken and duck and various forms of meat and fish. And so these monks got very creative at making the first, what we call mock meat, or meat analogs from soy and from wheat and so forth. And they would make these meals and these banquets that looked like they were actually meat, but they weren't. And everybody was happy, right? I mean, and so they're ahead of us 100 years, or excuse me, probably a 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And I have to say, quite honestly, since the World Peace Diet has been translated, my main book, into Chinese, both traditional and simplified Chinese, we've been going a lot to Taiwan and also to mainland China and also Korea and Vietnam. And it's so refreshing, I have to say, to go to a country where the main religion in that country is trying to get everybody to go vegan.
Mm.
Right? They're trying to promote the vegan message. That's what they're doing. And
wow.
And they actually help, you know, pay my flight, and I go
wow.
and I speak, and they get, you know, hundreds of people to come, fill up a hall to have me speak about the benefits of veganism for animals, for the earth, for our health, and so forth. And this is what they consider is a very important part of the teaching. That's alive and living today in China and in Taiwan. And we'll be going again, actually, in a few months. So this is really, you know, where we really see the actual fruits of this, too, I think, today.
Well, that's good. The timing is right, because there's so much marketing going on to get animal products into Asian countries right now.
Right. Right,
yeah,
exactly. There's
gotta give
so
them
much
some pushback.
Oh,
yeah. And they're seeing, unfortunately, the results with increased rates of diabetes that were never seen before, and heart disease that were never seen before. And now, thanks to animal food, processed food, they look just like us, big and fat.
Right. That's so true. I know. I mean, I shouldn't laugh. It's really not funny.
It's not funny.
I mean, it's so much suffering. And also, just to see how their environment, the air, and water, especially the water being depleted and polluted and so forth. So at least China, the government, has actually gotten behind the message and is encouraging people to eat less meat. And I'm hoping that that's going to spread to some other countries as well. I think Taiwan also is doing the same thing, because they realize it's much better, not only for the people's health, but also for their environment.
Can you explain about being a mendicant or a beggar, and why it's okay to ask for food, and how it's done? Because I was reading that there's, well, I'll get to that in a minute.
Well, yeah, I cannot actually say from my own experience. I've never personally done that. In Korea, when I was a Zen monk in Korea, that the monks no longer practice that. That's not practiced anymore in most countries. It's not practiced in Japan or in China, Korea, Vietnam. It is still practiced in Thailand. So the monks, so I know people, I mean, I have friends who have been or are mendicants, and they go out, and it works. You know, I mean, the people in the villages are used to expecting them to come around every day just before noon. And they have some food ready for them, and they get put it in their bowl, and then that's what they get to eat. And it was considered, I have to say, I mean, being in Korea myself as a monk with a shaved head and robes and the whole thing, it's very deep in the psyche of the people, the lay people who are Buddhists, to honor and respect monks. I mean, I had, you know, I would come into a room and they would be prostrating on the floor, you know, just because I was a monk, you know. I mean, so there's this tremendous, goes from generation to generation, respect for people who decide to give up everything, to not try to get any wealth or power or relationships, and just devote themselves to through cultivating their mind. So people in these countries respect that typically, and so someone who's a monk is really looked up to a lot. They're really revered, and so it's dangerous in a way. I mean, it's easy to get kind of a swelled head about it, like, oh, I'm superior, I'm a monk, or a nun. You know, it's kind of like the superiority thing. So I deserve to have meat or something. But you know, I remember like hearing the story of this one fellow who's very well known. He's kind of a well known, very good speaker. He's a mendicant. He was a mendicant monk. He was originally from England, a guy from England who decided he wanted to be a Buddhist monk. So he went to Thailand, and he was a vegetarian, in England. And he went there as a young novice monk and took the vows, and they shaved his head, and he started going around on the rounds to the villages. And they put, sometimes they put meat in his bowl, the villagers did, and he refused to eat it. And the head teacher reprimanded him and said, no. I mean, if they put meat in your bowl, you've got to eat it. So this guy went from becoming, from being a vegetarian to being a meat eater because he became a Buddhist monk. I mean, that's how backwards it is. And actually, he went on then later to start a big Buddhist meditation center in Perth, Australia. And I was invited to go to Perth and speak a few years ago. And a lot of the students at that center wanted me to come and give a lecture at that Buddhist meditation center that he started, talking about the benefits of vegan living, and he refused to even let me come and speak.
Wow.
Wow. So that kind of shows how,
yeah.
how it's so weird. It's like Buddhism really should be promoting compassion for animals, but unfortunately, it can also work the other way because of, like we talked about earlier, these three excuses that people say, well, if it wasn't killed just for you, it's okay. So it's really, I think, but overall, I have to say things are moving in a good direction. I mean, overall, I think more and more we're seeing there's just a big questioning of Buddhist monks eating meat. And like the Tibetan Buddhist center that I was in where we fed our lama meat, that whole tradition is now vegetarian, at least, so that wouldn't happen anymore. So it is moving in a positive direction.
It's not just in Buddhism. It's as being a vegan, for example, and you go somewhere and people have made a dinner and you refuse to eat it. Some people will say that that's rude. Or if you travel to another country where there's a culture and they're supposed to do something and you refuse,
right?
People say that's rude. And so there are different reactions. I know I'm not going to eat, knowingly, any animal. And,
right.
And in some of the book, there's this discussion about when we eat animals, we're eating suffering, we're eating their pain, and we know it's not healthy, but there's so many other issues involved when taking in a living being.
Right, right. It's the two things, right? We're number one, we're causing the suffering, basically. I mean, anyone who's eating animal foods typically is, on some level, is causing the suffering because of us eating the meat or dairy. Somewhere an animal had to be confined and killed and impregnated against her will to supply that. If I'm eating it, I'm depleting the supply, so it's going to happen again. I had to buy it or order it or something. And then not only do we cause all that suffering and misery and terror and fear and pain, then we turn around and we actually eat it and build this temple, really. I mean, our body, in a sense, is a temple in the sense that our body and mind are the vehicles, the only vehicles we have for happiness, for creativity, for love, for awareness, for living our lives. So, our basic wisdom would tell us, gosh, be aware of what you're eating. Be aware of the toxins that are in the food. Be aware of what I refer to in the World Peace Diet as the metaphysical toxins, eating terror and fear and pain and despair. It's not a good idea to be eating that and feeding that to our children. When we want to create a life of happiness and harmony and joy and freedom and abundance and so forth, it's just the opposite of that. Animal agriculture really, in many ways, is demonic in the sense that it's based on bringing out the worst in people who practice it, and then for us who are eating the foods and just numbing ourselves, numbing our emotions, desensitizing our thoughts and our feelings, is really the opposite of what Buddhism is about, and I think really all spiritual traditions, which is about awakening. So I really think it's important to make a distinction between spirituality and religion. And religion really has a divided loyalty, which spirituality does not have. Spirituality is just one thing. It's basically wake up. You know, it's just awaken out of the cultural trance. But religion, you know, it's designed to help us hopefully awaken spiritually. But also religion, all religions also have a loyalty to their society.
It's a form of programming, too.
It's a form of programming, right. They want us to go to the church barbecue or whatever it is and be part of the cultural norms and values we're learning through religion. So religion's very divided, and that's, I think, why a lot of vegans rightly want to reject religion, because religion has become, in many cases, very perverted by the society. But underlying religion is the pure goals, really, of spiritual awakening, which is just awakening. It's not anything that you can ever encapsulate in any kind of system. It's actually just our heart and our mind reaching higher and broader and deeper to understand who that we are.
Can we talk about the five contemplations, the Buddhist grace?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful thing for people to even think about one of these things, if not all five, before they're eating.
Yeah, I think, what I say myself every day when I eat something, I have a little saying, may we partake of this food, ever mindful of its true source. May we partake of this food, ever mindful of its true worth. May we be ever mindful that it sustains the temple wherein the spirit resides, and may the uses of the temple take us up the mountain of karma to the summit of enlightenment. So there's this basic idea of seeing the true worth of food at a much deeper level than what we normally see it when we're just eating. The five contemplation verse that is traditional in the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism is, I'll just say it here for everybody, this offering of the faithful is the fruit of work and care. I reflect upon my conduct. Have I truly earned my share? Of the poisons in the mind, the most destructive one is greed. As a medicine cures illness, I take only what I need. To sustain my cultivation and to realize the way, so we contemplate with gratitude on this offering today. This offering of the faithful is the fruit of work and care. So those are the five contemplations. It's basically to reflect upon the food that we're eating. And monks say this. We used to say something similar in the monastery in Korea. If we're really worthy of the food, you know, that basic idea. Am I on my own contemplation and making an effort to awaken for the benefit of all beings sufficiently to be worthy of all of the water and the land and the effort that people have put in to bring this food to me? Because if we're, as a monk, very often we're living essentially on the work of other people. They're giving us their food. So we have to, therefore, make sure that we're really doing what we can to be worthy of that.
But so many of us are living off the work of other people,
right,
when it comes to
right.
eating. We take it for granted because we give money. But if that food stopped being grown and stopped being distributed, a lot of us would go hungry.
I know, and it's true. Most people have no idea how to grow food. It's such a disconnect we have. We're not really aware of where food comes from. One of the things we really love now that we don't have an RV, we lived in an RV for 17 years. All I could grow was sprouts, but now we have a food forest, and you know, we've planted a lot of fruits and vegetables, and fruit trees and vegetables and herbs and berries and things. And really, it's quite a lot of work to be out there and planting and weeding and harvesting and working with the land. And it gives us a much more of a sense of respect for food and the great gift that it is.
I think, though, like very often with prayers, you can get numb to the words that you're saying and not even realize what you're saying. So
right.
The idea that it's a contemplation every time you say it, you really need to, what am I saying? What does this mean today?
Exactly. Yeah, it's important to have a feeling and to cultivate the feeling, however that is for, I think, for the individual, a sense of gratitude, a sense, really, I mean, for me, that's one of the main core problems in our society is that we do not want to think deeply about where our food came from if we're eating meat, dairy products, and eggs. It's no way we want to think about that. It's the worst possible thing. So every meal is teaching us, essentially, to stay disconnected from our food. We don't want to think of the terrible abuse of cows when we're eating cheese or ice cream, and we don't want to think about the poor hens, how their beaks are chopped off when we're eating eggs, or the terror and pain of animals if we're eating animal flesh. Of course, we don't want to think about that. We don't want anyone to talk about it. We just want to stay shallow and not question the program that we're doing. And again, what any authentic spiritual path or path of awakening in any way is asking us to look deeply, to listen deeply, to make an effort to understand deeply. And that means, especially when we're eating, being aware of the ripples of our food, like where it came from, what it's going to, not only what it took to bring it to our plate, but what it does to our body after it leaves our plate when we're eating it. And this is something that I think is at the heart of really the problems we're having in our world today, is that we're just living, all of us are born into a culture where we're wounded. We're forced to become shallow and disconnected and just eat the flesh and secretions of horribly tortured and abused animals, just as if it's like that's normal, and to disconnect from what we're doing. And my PhD at Berkeley was in educating intelligence, and intelligence is the capacity to make connections. So when the main ritual in every society is to disconnect, it's actually reducing our intelligence, mm-hmm. both cognitively and emotionally on every level. And it explains a lot, I think, of how we can be really doing such unintelligent things as a society. We have billions of dollars we could spend and productively, but we use it for terrible, violent, earth-destroying things. And again, that's eating animal foods, reducing our intelligence. And it's interesting that in the Buddhist tradition, there's always this emphasis on listening deeply, and feeling deeply. And the Bodhisattva is someone who's dedicated their lives to reducing the suffering of others. That's sort of the ideal. All of us can be bodhisattvas. All of us can dedicate our lives to reducing the suffering of others. And one of the main bodhisattvas is, people have probably seen statues of Kuan Yin, or that's the Chinese word, Chenrezi, or Avalokiteshvara. This is the bodhisattva of compassion. It's a deity, but lives within each one of us as an aspect of our own consciousness. We all have within us a radiant capacity in our consciousness to be compassionate and kind. And that word, Avalokiteshvara, in Sanskrit, literally means one who hears the cries of the world. Mm. And I think that's the key, it's being willing to listen, we talked about earlier, silence. When we get quiet enough and we don't speak and we're just listening and we're practicing listening, pretty soon we can listen deeply enough to hear the inner wisdom that's in our hearts, and deeper than that, the suffering in the world, in a way that we open to it. And when we open to that, it doesn't mean that our life gets terrible. It means we're deepened, we're maybe saddened by that. But it does mean, I think, that we begin to embrace that as a reality. We're not afraid of it. And then we can, from that foundation, begin to actually get active, actually do something to help relieve that suffering. Whether that activity is like what you're doing, to have conversations and create recipes and organizations and contexts to share this message, or if it's something more like creating movies or whatever it is, or even just meditating in the silence, just sending love out to the world. I think all of these are actions that we can engage in that will help to heal the situation.
So we've been talking about your book, Buddhism and Veganism, which you edited and you contributed several chapters to. And we've been touching on some of the concepts that are discussed in this book, but there are different chapters written by different people, and they share their stories of becoming Buddhist and becoming a vegan. They share, it's a wide variety of topics that are covered that are all kind of connected. We learn about all the things that are wrong with animal agriculture. Some of them are harder to read than others. When you talked about, we were just talking about compassion and learning to listen. There are a lot of angry vegans in the world. And
right.
I think they need a little splash of Buddhism. There was one chapter talking about listening to a friend who was a butcher.
Right.
And surprised to hear the butcher, who was a son of a family of butchers, actually express that he knew what he was doing and wasn't that happy about it, but really didn't know how else to make a living. And
right.
That's where the compassion comes in. We need to learn to listen and understand where everyone's coming from.
Right. You know, that's such a good point, Karen. I think the whole idea is that it's easy for us, in a sense, to be outraged and angry at people who are eating animal foods, or, like you say, you know, people who are causing, like the butcher or something like that. And I think a lot of people in the beginning stages, we're just kind of consumed by this anger. If we go vegan, we see an undercover video, and we just are outraged by what's happening. And the thing we need to understand, though, is how to be skillful in our approach to help relieve the suffering. And if I'm just angry and blame and shame and criticize people, is that going to actually change any behavior? Is that going to bring any light to the situation? Or does that actually just serve mainly to reinforce stereotypes and divisions? And in many ways, I think the most important thing we can do when we make the transition to veganism is to realize that we're not done. Just because I'm vegan doesn't mean I'm perfect. I'm done now. I'm fully enlightened. To realize that this is just the beginning, in many ways, of an ongoing adventure of discovery, and that our life is an adventure wherever we are on the path. So now that we've maybe been able to make this very wonderful transition, so we're not paying for eating and consuming foods and products that are derived from animals, we can begin to learn more and deepen our understanding so that we become more effective as advocates and more effective in bringing this message to other people. And then I think we begin to realize the basic truth. I think Gandhi said it very well. He said, without positive personal change, there can never be positive social change. And to actually change ourselves so that we're embodying what veganism is. And what is veganism? It's essentially love and kindness and respect for others, for animals, and for human animals, who can very often be the most challenging of all. So that when we're engaged in dialogue or talking to people, we're sharing our own story in a way with them that is respectful, and also listening to them and being willing to hear their story as well. And I think this is happening. I think that the vegan movement is maturing. There's still a lot of angry vegans, but I think people are more understanding that that's a relatively shallow stage, and that as we deepen our veganism, we begin to realize that we are called to transform ourselves so that we're actually embodying veganism as radical inclusion, as, you know, respect and kindness for others who are different from me, and to simply do the best we can to exemplify what veganism is in our every thought, word, and deed. And I think when we do that, we begin to less be a force to try to change other people and more be a force to plant seeds in the consciousness of other people so that those seeds will be watered by their own compassion and wisdom. And when they go vegan, which they will, if we plant the seeds well, it'll be their own choice. It won't be because they're being pressured into it. It'll be something that comes to them because we can exemplify that. And I think creating communities based on this is really very, very powerful. Like, that's what how I changed. I talked about the farm in Tennessee or Sungwangsa Zen Monastery in South Korea. Now, these are communities where everyone is living in this way, and we can create all kinds of communities. Like you were talking, I think we heard earlier about the Veggie Pride Day. You know, that that's like a one-day community, right? Everybody
yes.
you know, is embodying this, and it's fantastic. That's where people really make changes. They see people, they understand the ideas, they see an example, they get to try the food, veg fests and sanctuaries and restaurants and talk shows. These are all examples of communities that we can help inspire and create.
And wow, well, we yeah. have a minute and a half left, Will.
Oh, okay.
And I have like a long list of questions that I never got to. It's okay. I did want to ask where all of the contributors came from, but we only have like about 30 seconds to mention
yeah.
them. So whatever you want to say before we go.
Yeah, I'm really grateful to all the contributors. You know, these are people who are all vegans, and they're also all Buddhist practitioners from various traditions. We have some from the Mahayana, some from the Theravada, and some from the Vajrayana. These are the three main schools in Buddhism. And they're people that I've basically met over the many years I've been a Buddhist and a vegan. And they all, I think, have a wonderful contribution to make of understanding to how we can live our lives in harmony with each other and with animals in these critical times.
Mm. So. Will Tuttle, Dr. Will Tuttle, thank you so much for joining me, and It's All About Food, and for putting this book together, so important, Buddhism and Veganism. It was such a pleasure to talk with you today, and I hope to be in your presence close again sometime soon.
Thank you, Karen. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And, yeah, the book is available through our website, worldpeacediet.com, or just in, you know, on Amazon, anywhere, if you're interested in these ideas.
Very good. Well, you've been listening to another episode of It's All About Food, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com and send me an email at info@realmeals.org. And please remember, have a delicious week.